Into the Fold is part of the Texas Podcast Network, the conversations changing the world. Brought to you by the University of Texas at Austin, the opinions expressed in this podcast represent the views of the hosts and guests and not of the University of Texas at Austin.
And just remembering the opportunities that I had had as being the daughter of immigrants, to know that what we have to do is really ensure that it's not solely saying it's an individual's responsibility, but it's also it's society's responsibility to ensure that the conditions are there that actually promote opportunity, equity, health, and well-being.
Hi, welcome to Into the Fold, a podcast on mental health issues. I'm your host, Ike Evans, and today we're delighted to bring you episode 109, Declaring Racism a Mental Health Crisis.
When we talk about well-being, for me, it's the person's ability to thrive.
Having their basic needs met, as well as having community and connection.
I think looking at an individual or a community in its entirety.
These are the moments where it's not only about celebrating, but it's about connecting with people and connecting with the community around you.
Well-being is when you are feeling kind of your best, and best, I think, is a moving target.
And supporting one another, continually talking to one another, sharing our resources, a community, that golden thread.
Last September, the Hawk Foundation came out publicly with a unique statement, a declaration of racism as a mental health crisis. The purpose of the declaration is to call attention to the link between racial injustice and mental health, and to argue that racism undermines our collective health and well-being. The statement was first published to the Hawk Foundation website, where you can still find it, at the end of September of 2020. The idea for the declaration was first conceived at the last meeting of the Hawk Foundation with its National Advisory Council. The declaration positions racial justice as key to the overall promotion of mental health and as a leading-edge principle for thought leaders in the health and mental health space to adopt. To date, over 200 organizations have co-signed the declaration. They include heavy hitters such as Trust for America's Health, National Council for Behavioral Health, and Prevention Institute. To quote from the declaration, "With so much evidence supporting the reality of this crisis, it is incredible that it has taken all of us until now to name it. Still, the power of explicitly naming a crisis, especially in public health literature, should not be understated. It lays a foundation for future researchers studying inequities, and it validates the threat racism poses to society by equating it with other threats to public health and mental health, like the opioid crisis, foodborne outbreaks, and the COVID-19 pandemic." Our esteemed guests for this episode are Dr. Nadine Gracia, Executive Vice President of Trust for America's Health, Jose Ramon Fernandez Pena, recent President-elect of the American Public Health Association, and our own Dr. Octavio N. Martinez Jr., Executive Director of the Hawk Foundation for Mental Health. We're here for a conversation about the declaration and how a broad effort to take its principles to heart can shape all of our futures for the better. Welcome to all of you.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Thank you, Ike.
Okay, so the first question is for Dr. Martinez. Perhaps you could start us off by, you know, providing your own rationale for the declaration, as well as thoughts on what the Hawk Foundation is trying to achieve in adopting it.
Very good, Ike. Well, one thing that we have all experienced, everyone across the United States and, of course, here in Texas, is how the pandemic had unveiled the deep-seated inequities in healthcare for our communities of color. And it amplified social and economic factors that contributed to poor health and mental health outcomes. And one thing that was just really fabulous to see was how many organizations, nonprofits, even cities, excellent organizations like the American Public Health Association, Trust for America's Health, who are here with us today as examples. We're calling out how racism truly was a public health crisis and a public health issue. But one thing that I noticed was that as great as that was and how important it was, I wasn't exactly seeing mental health being called out as well. And we're kind of hypersensitive at the Hogg Foundation, Ike, as you and I know, because for so long we've been fighting the stigma against mental health and substance use, and also parity and how important that really is. And so I felt it was important enough of a difference to be able to also then, let's make a declaration from the Hogg Foundation that mental health in and of itself needs to be called out and is equally important when it comes to public health, physical health overall. And so within that context, to the second part of your question of why is it important for the Hogg to do that, I think it was important for the Hogg Foundation to, not only because I think it needed to be called out, and you need to call out an issue when you want to address it, you have to identify it, but also it was important for us internally as a foundation that has said, you know, diversity, equity, and inclusion are values of ours. And if that's the case, then we need to be transparent about it, because it puts us, so to speak, out there and available for others to question and to criticize. And we value that because it helps us to become a much better and stronger, I think, organization and stay true to our values. And so within that context, I think between internally what it did for us, but also to let our constituents, our stakeholders, and our colleagues out there know how important of an issue this was.
All right. Dr. Gracia, this next question is for you. Our declaration follows in the footsteps of similar pronouncements by prominent organizations, including your own, Trust for America's Health. Last June, you put out a statement standing in solidarity with those opposing racism and seeking racial justice, and you followed that statement, issuing a blueprint for the 2021 administration and Congress, which affirms racism as a public health crisis, and recommending an all-out effort to combat racism and other forms of discrimination. So did your statement and is the the Trust for America's Health Blueprint report having the impact that you hoped that it would? And how have things changed since those were released?
No, thank you, Ike, and thank you for the invitation to join this conversation. It's really a pleasure to be here and engaging in such an important conversation. I think I would actually piggyback off of what Dr. Martinez said with regards to our core values. When you look at Trust for America's Health, we are a nonprofit, nonpartisan public health policy research and advocacy organization, and one of our core values is on promoting equity and is also a core strategic priority for the organization. And in following on issuing our statement, standing in solidarity with those opposing racism and standing for racial justice, we importantly did talk about the fact that racism undermines health and well-being and equity and opportunity. And we felt it important to raise that as an issue as well in the blueprint for the 2021 administration and Congress, which is a report that we issue with every presidential administration and transition. And in that report, importantly, we talked about the importance of the White House and Congress, for example, making advancing equity and eliminating disparities a national priority, and indeed mobilizing really an all-out effort to address and dismantle structural racism. What we have seen since that time, we released the report in October of last year, as we've seen with the new administration, for example, on the first day of the administration, the signing of an executive order by President Biden on advancing racial equity and looking at this throughout government and charging the federal departments and agencies to look at their policies and programs to identify where federal policies and programs actually put certain communities at a disadvantage and how to really create more equitable opportunity. And we also really called for the need for leadership and a review within agencies and see that through the leadership of the Domestic Policy Council that is going to be doing this kind of systematic review government-wide. It really takes that kind of whole of government equity approach to ensure that we're actually looking at how structures and systems have continued to promulgate and perpetuate inequities, certainly in communities of color, low-income communities, and other communities that have been marginalized for generations.
Thank you for that. Wonderful answer. Dr. Jose Ramon Fernandez Pena, you are, I think, the newly elected president of the American Public Health Association, and you only just recently found out about our declaration. And I think you're even still fairly new to, you know, the Hogg Foundation and kind of the, you know, the scope of our work. So I was just curious about, you know, what your thoughts are and you know, what parts of the declaration stood out to you.
Thank you for the question, and thank you for the invitation to be here with you. I am new to the work of your foundation, although I just learned that it's been around for quite a while. That's my bad, but I'm not new to the field of public health and to the issues of structural inequities and unequal access to health services. A couple of things strike me about the declaration, and one of them is the calling out the fact that racism is in fact a mental health crisis as well. I mean, there's very many documents and publications out there that talk about the impact of continued racist experiences, for example, in pregnant mothers, the high levels of cortisol and its relationship to infant mortality rates among African-American women and things like this work. I think that for all of us in the health sector in general, especially in the public health sector, really shifting the conversation from calling race a factor in mental health and switching that into naming racism as a factor that actually has a significant impact on health outcomes across the communities that have been historically oppressed or maintained away from access to services. For me, in the line of work that I've been doing over the past 20 years in the area of health workforce diversity, the field of mental health is one that I always call out because of the fact that when you look at the providers of mental health services and you look at the diversity of the population seeking those services, there's no match there at all. And in mental health services, if I cannot find a provider that speaks my language, perhaps, or understands my culture, I essentially have no services. It's if my dentist speaks my language or understands my culture or not, it's really not relevant. I can still have my tooth pulled. But when I try to engage in that kind of deeper personal conversation, you need to have that kind of parity. And that lack of parity in and of itself is rooted in racist practices that have prevented individuals from getting into those kinds of careers. So it's a pretty circular process that makes perfect sense, and it gives us yet another platform on which to stand and speak about the need to diversify the health workforce.
So one challenge of panel discussions like this is getting out of the realm of the abstract and making it more personal. But I can't help but wonder how each of you personally relates to the issues that, you know, that we've been talking about. I mean, how do your personal stories make, for example, a concept like health equity a little bit clearer for people? And let's go in reverse order. So, Jose Ramon, I think you're up again.
Well, if I were to speak about my personal story, and it's not a matter of oversharing here, but I can tell you that when I was living in New York City in the 80s and 90s and working very hard as a volunteer on HIV services and community health education, HIV prevention, I experienced a number of big losses at the time. Among them, my own partner died of AIDS. So I was in sore need of mental health services, and I was referred by my HMO to a particular person. And when I met with them, I said, yeah, well, you know, I feel in Spanish. I need to convey those feelings in Spanish. And the gentleman before me, who was very white and very Anglo-looking, opened his mouth and spoke to me in perfect Spanish. So I was able to find the services I needed because I was very, very lucky. But of all the services available, I would have not been able to really find the support and the guidance that I needed at a time of grief and need. So I relate very personally to the importance of this parity between the providers and the population seeking health services. And the work of that I've been doing over a long time is in fact in working with immigrants that are health professionals in the countries of origin. And when they come to the US, they end up driving Uber. My program works with them to try to return them to the health workforce in some capacity and thus infuse this workforce with cultural language and different perspectives to enrich what our health workforce.
Nadine, I'm dying to hear what you have to say.
Yes, and first I just want to acknowledge Dr. Fernandez-Pena. Thank you for sharing your story and my sympathies to you on the passing of your partner. Thank you for sharing that. I would say that my personal story starts really with my family. I'm a first generation Haitian American, and my parents came to the U.S. from Haiti, where they were both educators and came to the U.S. and had very humble beginnings. My mother was a nanny. My father painted boats for $1.75 an hour, where in Haiti, he was a school principal. My mother was a teacher. But when they came to the U.S. and started in their first jobs, they didn't feel the need to have to tell their coworkers their former professions in Haiti. They knew that respect would be earned by their hard work. And that's what they taught my siblings and me, and to persevere even through adversity. And it was through them that I saw the many blessings and opportunities that I had. But I also then saw the lack of opportunity for others. And I found it to be my mission and life's work to want to ensure that everyone has a fair and just opportunity to get a quality education, to live in a community where they can thrive and be able to have opportunity to explore various professions. But I saw that wasn't always the case. And I saw that early on in my youth through volunteer activities and then in college and beyond. And so when I think about health equity, I think about really ensuring, how do we ensure that where there are these systems that as Dr. Fernandez-Pena said, you know, it's not just by luck, but really that the systems themselves actually promote equity and opportunity for everyone. How do you create those kinds of systems? It translated into me pursuing initially in my career, pursuing medicine as a desire to serve others, and seeing in my training where we were serving communities where getting to our clinic was difficult because of a lack of transportation or being food insecure and trying to assist the patients and families that we were caring for. And just remembering the opportunities that I had had as being the daughter of immigrants, to know that what we have to do is really ensure that it's not solely saying it's an individual's responsibility, but it's also it's society's responsibility to ensure that the conditions are there that actually promote opportunity, equity, health, and well-being. And so every time that I think about the types of work that we do, whether it's in policy or programs or advocacy, I always consider those really who are marginalized and excluded, and how do we actually ensure that they have a voice at the table? How do we ensure that their needs are being met so that we can truly reach the full potential, I think, for not only our nation, but our world?
And Dr. M?
Thank you, Ike. I also do want to acknowledge your loss, Dr. Fernandez-Pena. I know how hard it must be to lose a loved one. And Dr. Gracia, for sharing your story as well and insights. What makes me think about Ike is when I was in training and I was in San Antonio and I was doing my medicine and psychiatry rotations, to Dr. Fernandez-Pena's point about the incongruity between patients and the providers. So they're not, at the time, it wasn't even cultural linguistic competency, wasn't as well known as it is now, and the progress has been made, though there's still much to be done, as we all know. But one thing that struck me was being taught as a resident the concept of a non-compliant patient. as an example, and how we immediately would, it was happens at the front desk, and the doctor reviews the chart. Yes, is not a compliant patient. It gets put in the chart, and how it stays in the chart for the rest of the time of an individual. Until I remember I was in clinic on the southeast side of San Antonio, and I remember I was waiting for a patient to come who I had spoken to on the phone. So I knew she was very keen on accessing my services. There was something definitely very troubling that she was having to deal with. And as clinics go, they're very busy. And the nurse came in and it said, well, this patient didn't show, so she's non-compliant. They want to, you know, chart it, which means they're going to put it in the record once again for another meeting. But so the clinic goes on and I go in and see the next patient. It was 2 hours after the clinic appointment, though, that the woman did finally show up. We're getting close to the closing time. So I luckily heard her voice from the back where I was in the doctor's offices. And so I got up to go see. And of course, they were turning her away and wanted to reschedule her for months away from when she needed to be seen. And my question then is, let me talk to this lady. Well, what I discovered was that, it was a rainy day, so there was weather involved. She didn't own her own transportation. They had to rely on public transportation. She lived on the other side of the city. Getting to Dr. Fernando Espeña's point, she sought out a Hispanic Latino psychiatrist specifically, found one. So that's why she was kind of excited. But she had to take 2 bus transfers to get to our clinic so she could be seen. So what happens? Well, the bus is late because it's raining. 2, there was horrible traffic. So it took her for a long time, 2 hours. She was late. I'm sorry, but this is a systems issue. Getting to Dr. Gracia's point, she has no control over the transportation system. She has no control over the weather, but yet she's the one that's going to have to suffer the consequences of those things because no one was taking into consideration the social determinants she was having to deal with just to get a doctor's appointment to hopefully see, hopefully a psychiatrist that she could actually then maybe have a good rapport with to then get the treatment going. So I told him, no, I will see this individual. This woman has travailed all day long to try to get here. Not to mention, of course, at the time, they didn't call them essential workers, but she was one, she worked in the service industry. So she had to lose a day's work to boot income of her own to try to actually access psychiatric services. And so it's just insult upon insult when we don't take the time to understand how important an equity lens is and the impact that it can truly have on an individual's health. And it also shows the systemic organizational component, which is, are we training our front desk personnel to also have that lens and understand? So that, because there are multiple, sort of contact points that we have to be aware of and ensure that we're not only doing at the individual level, like at the provider level, but the organizational and the systems level, like Dr. Gracia was pointing out.
Okay. And thank you all of you for kind of sharing some what I'm sure must still be somewhat fraught memories and just and recollections of your own encounters with our inequitable system. So I really appreciate that. So let's use our imaginations and envision a world where health equity was achieved. What is a concrete example of something that would be different, or easier, or transformed? Something you can use to illustrate how the world has changed. And I'm throwing that out to all three of you, whoever wants to take a swing at that.
If I may offer a big one for me, I would say we're living in a world where access to health services is not contingent upon employment.
Okay.
Dr. Fernandez, Peña, I love that one. The one I was going to throw out is that in a world where equity does exist, and it's for us in the public health field, it's a really big one, which it's a huge metric we follow, infant mortality rate, that there would be no longer any identifiable differences that are based on race or ethnicity when it comes to the loss of a child that's less than 1 year of age, which is, and we use that to compare not only internally how well we're doing and what it says of our healthcare system, but of course across countries. That would just to me be such a wonderful thing, because I know that certain communities, especially like the Black community, they're losing way too many babies.
It's hard to say one thing. these are wonderful, wonderful examples. I would say it's just, we see the picture of that healthy, thriving, resilient community, you know, where a child is born and his or her future trajectory is not determined by racism, by his or her zip code, by her income status, but that every child has that opportunity, that the child has the opportunity to get a great education from early learning throughout their education, is living in a healthy, stable home and housing, and that families have access to healthy, affordable foods and aren't struggling to make ends meet, and that they're good jobs with livable wages and opportunities for economic mobility. And what we see is we break the cycle of intergenerational poverty and trauma. Instead, we see intergenerational prosperity from a health perspective, well-being, and opportunity.
Yeah, we live really in fantasy world now, but I love that world, Dr. Gracia. I would also love to live in the world where the health workforce really reflects the richness and diversity of the population it aims to serve.
Oh, that would be fabulous. I think, Dr. Gracia, you hit it out of the park there. You just sort of captured everything for me and Dr. Fernandez-Pena. You know, Ike, I'm going to tie it to the other question about a specific program. I'll take that one on just for a little bit, because I think it fits within the visions that have been laid out by Dr. Fernandez-Pena and Dr. Gracia, which is the Hawk Foundation currently we're wanting to stand up an office of health equity at the Health and Human Services Commission, which is at the state level. And there's fabulous amount of reasons of why we would want to do that and why it would help to ensure the vision that Dr. Gracia put forth would be, because you have to gather the right data, create the right metrics, analyze them, create dashboards for your community and for the system itself to ensure that it's doing and moving in the right direction. But imagine if every state had one, and of course the federal government had one, how we could ensure that it isn't just one state versus another is actually moving forward and has a better health, better and healthy population, but that we're all moving together, because I think that's where it really is the best for not only a country, but really a people. And of course one could expand it and say, well, that would be totally awesome. It was the entire world. And that would be really fabulous, but an Office of Health Equity is a piece of an overall puzzle that would be help us to start to move even with greater speed than we currently are to achieving that vision that Dr. Gracia laid out.
And if I can piggyback onto the
absolutely
the program aspect of it, you know, at Trust for America's Health, which I will say that Dr. Martinez, we are thrilled, is one of our wonderful board members, on our board of directors. At Trust for America's Health, you know, we advocate in particular for evidence-based policies that will help to advance prevention and equity. And in particular, an area that we are doing a great deal of advocacy and all of us have been speaking to this, is on the issue of social determinants of health. And in recognizing, for example, in the public health system and sector, that system has been chronically underfunded. And we understand in particular how our health is influenced by access to healthcare and the quality of healthcare that we receive. And it's also influenced by the social and economic conditions in which you live and work and grow. And so we are advocating for an investment in the social determinants of health, for example, to create a program at the Centers for Disease Control and Prevention to actually look at this issue and work across the agency to address the social determinants of health, but also to be able to award grants and fundings to states and localities to be able to actually engage in this work and partner across sectors from housing and education and transportation and criminal justice to do the vision of what Dr. Martinez talked about with these offices of health equity is to really embrace and understand that there are inequities we see in these social and economic conditions, and that it's not solely the responsibility of public health, but all of these sectors have a role to play. And being able to provide the resources to public health to really be able to help work on these issues is something that we are advocating for. And there's a bill that's been recently reintroduced into Congress, the Improving Social Determinants of Health Act, that we are seeing a lot of interest in, especially as we are in the midst of this COVID-19 pandemic and seeing how the social and economic inequities have really been exposed in addition to the health inequities through this pandemic.
Yeah, that's so important, Dr. Gracia. That's so important. I think that one of the things I want to applaud you for doing, Dr. Martinez and everybody, is really raising again the issue of mental health. The fact that we continue to have a conversation about mental health that is outside the conversation about health is completely ridiculous. The fact that my insurance may pay for unlimited access to my doctor, but only 12 visits to a mental health provider a year is completely ridiculous. So we need to be speaking up about the importance and the relevance of mental health, pandemics, COVID, natural disasters, fires, tornadoes, disclose once again or shine a bright light in all these fractures and all these inequities in our system and the provision of those systems. But we then forget about it and then we move on to the next thing. So COVID again has highlighted the need for mental health services, the impact of isolation, the impact of social distancing, the impact of everybody working from home, the need for those mental health services that are either unavailable or limited or not available in the languages that are needed is pathetic for a country like the United States. So thank you for putting this on the forefront. Thank you, Dr. Gracia, for raising this to the federal level. We just need to continue to do this, unfortunately.
Very well said, Dr. Fernandez-Pena. Thank you so much. Thank you, Dr. Gracia.
Okay, so we have about 5 minutes. So if there's anything else that any of you would like to mention or just, you know, throw into the conversation, now would be the time.
I would just like to add my appreciation to Dr. Martinez and the Hogg Foundation again for the leadership with regards to indeed being explicit in talking about racism as a mental health crisis as well, and making that connection to understanding that racism causes trauma. And now we are in the midst, certainly too, as we've been discussing, in the midst of this pandemic in which we are seeing raised levels of stress and anxiety and you know, from a whole host of issues, as Dr. Fernandez-Pena articulated. And in the midst of that, we also saw the racial injustice that has long existed, but yet we are also grappling with the racial reckoning of racism in our nation. And so the importance, there will be an even greater need, if you will, with regards to access to mental health services, access to services that are in particular culturally and linguistically appropriate and relevant to the community, so that there's trust to actually seek those services and feel like you're being respected and heard. And indeed to not separate that. And Trust for America's Health, we certainly also advocate on the importance of prevention and moving upstream to really look at how to create the conditions where we can promote mental health and well-being.
Okay. I would just add one thing, if it's okay.
Absolutely.
I feel that we're in a moment of awakening. If there's a silver lining to this pandemic, it really laid bare our gaps, our challenges, the existing disparities, the inequities that definitely exist, and the great work that the APHA is doing, Trust for America's Health, and others, and it's just not the Hogg Foundation. There's a lot of great colleagues and stakeholders around the country that are recognizing this is a time where, and an opportunity where we can really elevate not only our understanding, but to Dr. Gracia's point, let's actually start implementing the change that needs to happen. So it does feel like an awakening to me, and I hope that the progress continues. So I just want to end with that amazing word, hope, that there is hope, and we can ensure equity for all.
All right. Well, This has been a wonderful conversation. I feel very fortunate that I was able to get all three of you together at the same time, because you're all so extremely busy. I just want to wish you all just the best of luck with all of your great and important work, and that we appreciate having you. Thanks so much.
Thank you so much.
Thank you.
The Hogg Foundation has long argued that a robust mental health system is one that focuses on prevention as much as treatment. This is closely tied to our ongoing interest in addressing what we like to call the upstream causes of poor mental health. We tackled this issue head-on in episode 66, Moving Upstream, How Funders Can Address Root Causes. Here is a listen.
One of our goals is really to support communities in developing a stronger sense of social connectedness and supports, stronger sense of family, stronger sense of neighborhood, stronger sense of community. We believe that that health really starts at home. Again, very different from our history of funding programs and services, where we're really trying to bring our work into community level participation. And so I think, you know, again, all this really is aligned with our overall goal about supporting resilience, mental health, and well-being.
The voice you just heard was our own Rick Ybarra, program officer here at the Hogg Foundation. I've included a link to the full episode in the show description. I hope you check it out. Before signing off, I want to take this opportunity to address something that has been on my mind a lot lately. One of the nice things about doing communications for an organization like Hogg is knowing that, overwhelmingly, the people who follow us, who read our blog, subscribe to our emails, listen to the podcast, etc., overwhelmingly support us and our mission. But occasionally, and in particular on Facebook, we do occasionally receive critical or provocative comments, typically from people who take issue with our emphasis on mental health as it impacts specific communities, particularly communities of color and other historically excluded groups. And if you follow the podcast especially, you can't fail to notice that many of our guests claim or profess identities beyond those of person with mental health experience. While it may seem strange that the Hogg Foundation focuses so much on marginalized populations, I mean, after all, doesn't everyone struggle with mental health? It's worth remembering the systemic and structural nature of barriers to mental health. Health equity is at the core of our strategy because health is not solely an individual responsibility. It is also a product of community conditions. So we determined that we can make the most of our funding dollars as an organization and see the greatest strides in mental health by focusing on marginalized and historically underserved communities. Also, and just as important, we recently did an external audience survey as part of a larger review of our communications. And to an overwhelming degree, our audience values and indeed expects content that focuses on communities of color and other historically underserved communities, and is hungry for content that explores the intersection of mental health with other forms of disadvantage. But we do realize people can have differences of opinion on this, and so I encourage constructive feedback. If you have anything you'd like to share about how our focus on marginalized communities does or does not jibe with what you want to hear on a podcast, feel free to reach out to us at intothefold@austin.utexas.edu. And into the fold is all one word. Especially thoughtful comments will be acknowledged during a future episode. And that does it for this episode. We're glad you could join us. Just as taking care of ourselves enhances our ability to help others, so it is as well that by helping others, we enhance our own resilience. Please leave us a review and subscribe to us on iTunes, Apple Podcasts, Google Play Music, or TuneIn, and Spotify. Thanks for joining us.